Chapter 20. The plotter table within the Ultimus is not designed to handle military-grade inloads. Its Lexor Kale photon arrays were designed to distribute system-wide shipping timetables and manifest lists, not coordinate Legion war planning. Servatorin has been forced to make numerous alterations to its bio-organic cognitive centers. Most are sanctioned modifications, but a few are those taught to her by Coriel Zeth during her apprenticeship at the Magma City. Not forbidden per se, but frowned upon. Hest would have approved, and the thought of her binary life partner observing her work makes her smile. Colonel Hamadri and Captain Ulliet are present, but they are ghosts to her. Unaugmented and without nuspheric enablement, little more than blurs in her peripheral vision. All she sees is data. They are speaking softly, but she does not hear them. Kalth's atmospherics are lousy with rad squalls, but Torin has learned to compensate for this. She adjusts her filters, and the optics of the geosats respond to her commands. Static blurs, holographics waver, resolution refreshes, and she sees what she needs to see. She reads the energy signatures of buried power sources, thermal blooms from what are most likely barrack structures. Everything the word-bearers have tried to hide is laid bare before her, and she relishes the godlike aspect of her current position. Everything she is seeing is consistent with the deployment characteristics known of the word-bearers. Heat patterns are consistent with Legione's Astartes power plants, and this reassures her that nothing significant has changed since the last X-load from the geosats. Half a dozen savants and logi are plugged into the table, each assigned to a command element of the assault force. The geosats send their findings back to Arcology X in compressed data blurts, which are then passed to the attacking ultramarines. Each space marine commander has his own dedicated battle savant to break the data inloads into packets of information more easily digested by those without cognitive process augmetics. The bioarchitecture of space marine brains is greatly enhanced compared to mortals, but they are not mechanicum.
"Geosats will remain overhead for another 53 seconds," says a savant with dark skin and warm eyes that are still his own. 5-3 seconds.
His accent is equator thick, and Torin likes the flexing epenthesis of his words. She watches the inloading data spread through the plotting table, the gold icons moving in a carefully orchestrated ballet. Everything moves with precision. Every sweep and thrust made by the warriors of the 13th is perfectly coordinated. It does not feel like watching a battle. It feels like watching a replay of a battle. Her eyes flick to a nuspheric countdown hovering over the rune, indicating the force element containing Captain Ventanus. Chapter 21. The shadow sword fills with crackling electrical feedback as its main gun fires. Static charge lifts energized dust fragments from armor plates and makes the hairs on the back of his neck stand to attention. Ventanus could have ridden into battle within a land raider, but the awesome destructive potential of the shadow sword was too great to resist. On the grainy picked slate before him, a wall disintegrates as the super heavy's main gun obliterates it. This is a tank capable of killing battle engines. An ad hoc fortification has no chance. Bodies tumble from the wreckage, cultist bodies. Those that are still recognizable as human are on fire. Ventanus cannot hear their screams, but wishes he could. His capacity to enjoy the suffering of his enemies has become something feral. Ventanus activates the pressure seals that isolate his forward station from the rest of the super heavy. He wants to see Fodral Fell's stronghold laid waste with his own eyes. A green bulb lights up beside him. Pressure seal secure. He enters his command code onto an oversized keypad. The hatch above unlocks with a snap of vulcanized seals and Durasteel locking bars. It slides back, and Ventanus pushes himself upright. Flames surround the tank as it bludgeons its way through the outer reaches of Fodral Fell's defenses. Bands of Brotherhood warriors in scavenged exosuits run from the Shadow Sword. None of their weapons are capable of denting its thick armor, and they know it. Banks of heavy bolters mow them down as they flee, Streams of las and solid rounds soar through their disordered ranks. Plumes of hot blood puff from their exploding bodies like geothermal geysers. Then Tarnus slews the pintle-mounted combi bolter around and hauls back on the arming lever. The magazine engages with a satisfying clatter, and he mashes the trigger. The recoil of a combi bolter is ferocious, more suited to the man-capable tanks that are Terminators, but the Shadow Sword's assembly and his Genhan strength keep his rounds on target. Bodies detonate, reduced to meat and gristle. Here and there, a warrior band holds its ground. Ventanus has brief glimpses of iron masks, ragged robes, and wholly inadequate rad shielding. They fire weapons that are sub-army in quality and effectiveness. He wonders how such rabble ever gained a foothold on Kalth. He kills them as soon as he sees them. There are no word-bearers among the cultists, but everything he saw of the fighting before the retreat below ground displayed total disregard for their mortal allies. The humans are here only to slow the Ultramarines' advance, to soak up their fury. If that is Fel's plan, then he has sorely underestimated the well of fury from which the 13th Legion can draw. Ventanus savours the sight of hundreds of Ultramarines' tanks thundering over the hellish wasteland of Fel's outer fortifications. To either side of him, land raiders rear up over hastily raised berms of scorched earth, slamming back down with thunderous force. The enemy warriors who have held their ground are crushed beneath their tracks or buried in the dust. Squadrons of predators fire syncopated volleys of heavy las fire, and the fiery contrails of whirlwind missiles arc overhead in dizzying numbers. Squadron upon squadron of land speeders flit like murderous raptors over the battlefield, strafing exposed enemy fortifications. Their multi-melters breach bunkers, and assault squads drop in their wake to end pockets of resistance with shrieking chain blades and pistols. The burning cloud strides in from the east, its guns wreathed in smoke and light as it sears the sky with magma blasts. Mushrooming explosions erupt in the center of the fortifications. Adamantium walls are turned to slag with each impact. Air-bursting rockets flare from the Titan's void shields, and its warhorn sounds like booming laughter. Ventanus brings a tactical overlay onto his visor. Gold icons close like a fist on Fel's fortification, but these are just the outer layers, easily overcome. The real defenses are a kilometer ahead, towering walls that can withstand a Titan's guns, hellish bastions of dark steel and sunken bunker complexes that even a Shadow Sword will struggle to breach. But he has bigger guns than even a Reaver or a Shadow Sword can mount. Ventanus opens a vox channel to Arcology X. "Mir Edver Torin," he says. "Just like before." Chapter 22. Torin links with the orbital guns and disengages their safety protocols with an outward sweep of both hands, like an actor parting a curtain and taking the stage. It takes a moment for the multiple layers of security put in place since the invasion to disengage, but each platform comes under her command without issue. Every orbital gun is now slaved to Arcology X. She has control. "Brace for full bombardment," says Torin. Chapter 23. For a single, beautiful moment, Kalth's night ends. The poisoned air lights up. Daylight returns. But it is a false dawn, heralding not the promise of fresh beginnings, only endings. The undersides of clouds, heavy with acid rain, glow for an instant as high-powered lasers burn through them. Meson trails flash-burn the volatile, chemically-rich bands of vapour that have gathered above the strongpoint. The landscape is lit up for hundreds of kilometres, as the sky catches fire. All of this happens in an instant. Fractions of seconds later, searing beams of energy slice down from space like arrow-straight lightning. The beams make no sound in themselves, but the atmosphere ignites with their passage. Each impact is swiftly followed by a hard bang of displaced air. Ventanus watches it through the filtering insulation of his armor's auto-senses. Oral dampers resist deafening cracks of thunder that would otherwise rupture his eardrums. Visual protection keeps him from being blinded. Ceramite plates protect him from heat that would sear the flesh from his bones. The exposed cultists have no such protection, and their formations are reduced to swirling banks of meat smoke. Skeletons have the flesh burned from them, blood boils, and impregnable walls are left as little more than heaped rubble. The first wave of overpressure hits, and the ground quakes. The shadow sword rocks back on its suspension as the percussive blast slams into it like an army of contemptors, slamming its hull with graviton hammers. Ventanus leans into the blast wave, riding out the pummeling force. His link with the super-heavy tells him that numerous onboard systems have failed. Feed lines rupture, hydraulics burst, and delicate systems overload. A kilometre from the nearest impact point, and still, they're too close. Laser lances and kinetic rounds all slam down on Fodral Fell's stronghold, blowing out its pathetic blast shielding and rudimentary void fields. There is nothing left of the fortifications. Its soft underbelly has been exposed, and Ventanus has the harpoon ready to thrust. Excited chatter bursts over the box, 100 voices all saying the same thing. Did you see that? Throne! There can't be anything left alive in there! Ventanus knows there will be survivors. The word-bearers will not be dug out so easily. He cuts across the Vox network. We still have a practical to achieve, he says. Carry out your orders. The Ultramarines obey. Chapter 24. Hol Belloth watches in horror as the horizon lights up from end to end. He knows what he is seeing. A holocaust of orbital fire concentrated in one place. He has memorized the geography of Kalth and knows exactly who the wrath of the Ultramarines' guns is striking. Fell, he says. Malok Kartho nods. Hot winds whip around the headless tower, billowing Hol Beloth's cloak and filling his mouth with grey grit. The swaying motion of the tower forces him to keep his stance wide as the ground tilts alarmingly below him. He feels as though he stands upon the deck of a primitive longship. The sensation is not a welcome one. The devastation of Kalth is even more apparent from up here. It is a radiation-lashed death world that will always bear the mark of the word-bearers. Despite what he's seeing, he takes a moment of pride in that fact, even as his own skin blisters. More impacts slam into the ground, more fire lights the horizon. The first seismic shocks shake the tower, glass fragments rain from gaping frames. Structural supports buckle and tumble earthwards. The tower slumps into its splitting foundations. Collimated lance battery fire strikes the horizon. The hellish radiance it provides illuminates one stark fact. You knew this was coming, says Hol Belloth. Kartho shrugs, and Hol Belloth hates the gesture. It is a gesture of giving up, of not feeling enough to care that something precious is dying. That shrug tells him that Malok Kartho is no longer truly one of Lorgar's sons, but is becoming something else entirely. Fell had the biggest army, says Kartho, and the grandest ambition. Hol Belloth tries not to feel slighted, knowing it is absurd in the face of such destruction. He tries to follow Kartho's words to a logical conclusion, but those he reaches make no sense. Only one factor remains constant in his thoughts. You engineered this, didn't you? He says. Of course, replies Kartho. Fell and his warriors are gone, aren't they? Not yet, replies Kartho, struggling with the gorget seals at his neck. But soon. Why? Asks Hol Belloth, knowing now that he will have to kill the Dark Apostle. Kartho has crossed a line, though for what purpose he does not know. Service to the Dark Monarchs requires a degree of sacrifice, says Kartho, and the Ultramarines needed a target tempting enough to draw them from their cowardly bolt-hole. Kartho reaches up and removes his helmet. More accurately, he snaps his helmet apart in order to remove it. Zephyrs of dark smoke gust from within, and Hol Belloth sees just how far the Dark Apostle has come in his service to Lorgar's vision for the galaxy. Chapter 25. An electromagnetic haze hangs over the landscape. Dust swirls like ashen rain, and heat blooms ripple the air over terrain that has been boiled to glass by the heat of multiple lance strikes. The Shadow Sword crunches through the shattered remains of Fodral Fell's strongpoint. The orbital weapons have destroyed his sheltering walls with horrifying ease. Ventanus climbs down from the Shadow Sword. Its hull is hot to the touch, and the reactor ticks over noisily as it cools. Shapes move in the mist, but they are armored in cobalt blue and gold. They are ultramarines, and they are marching alongside him. His armor's external pickups register a wide spectrum of exotic radiations and a lethal cocktail of poisonous elements in the air. This is only to be expected when such potent energies have been unleashed. Staggered lines of Legion warriors advance into the molten remnants of the enemy fortress, bolt guns locked to their shoulders. They're blurred giants moving through a chemical fog that would dissolve the lungs of a mortal man with one breath. Ventanus has his bolt pistol drawn and his sword unsheathed. He does not expect to use either in the immediate future, but a captain must be seen to be ready to fight. He sees no sign of the word-bearers, but he knows that they will be here somewhere. They are Legion-trained and Legion-blooded. They will have survived this bombardment and will even now be readying a counterattack. Ventanus leads the Ultramarines deeper into the smoking, debris-strewn wasteland. The Shadow Sword rolls behind him, its engine a bone-deep rumble that he feels in his marrow. As the circle of Ultramarines tightens on the stronghold's center, a nagging suspicion takes shape in Ventanus's head, nebulous and unformed, but insistent. Scattered groups of Brotherhood soldiers have miraculously survived the barrage. They are blind and deaf, burned and desolate. They are slaughtered without mercy. The Ultramarines do not waste mass reactives on them. Who knows when they will be resupplied? Chain blades and fists put the enemy down, but there is little satisfaction in such wretched targets. "This is Ventanus," he voxes to his force commanders. "Report any sightings of enemy Legion forces." There are no reports of contacts beyond the scalded, crippled forms of the enemy's mortal soldiery, and Ventanus feels annoying worry, but something here is very wrong. "Where are the word-bearers?" he asks himself. If Fodral Fell is not here, then where is he? At the heart of the fortress, the Ultramarines find a vast crater, a nightmarish hell of electrical fires and scorched meat. Almost nothing is left standing, and what the barrage did not level in the opening moments, secondary explosions and burning ammunition depots have knocked flat. Here and there, Ventanus sees evidence of retrenchments and redoubts, but it is hard to make out anything for sure anymore. Torin's precision strikes have seen to that. The Shadow Sword's main gun traverses over his head, searching for a target, but finding nothing worthy of its fire. The burning cloud is silhouetted in the flames, a great engine of destruction standing over the doom of its foe. A dust and grime-coated warrior emerges from the haze and raises a hand.
"I thought there'd be at least someone left alive to fight," says Sidance.
"So did I," replies Ventanus, sheathing his sword and maglocking his pistol to his thigh.
"You think they died in the bombardment?"
"It looks that way," says Ventanus, though it seems too convenient an explanation.
"Not much of a fortress, then," says Sidance. "Lord Dorne would have words."
Ventanus says nothing in reply, his friend's words striking at the nagging suspicion that has been building ever since the first shots were fired. He stops in his tracks as his thoughts cohere on an inherent flaw in what has happened here.
"This fortress could never have stood," he says. "It's completely ridiculous."
"What are you talking about?"
"Why build anything we could level from orbit in moments?" says Ventanus. "Why build it above ground at all?
It doesn't make any sense."
"Maybe they couldn't find anywhere underground."
"They could have found somewhere to get underground," says Ventanus. "This isn't making any sense. Damn it, what are we missing?" The winds are clearing the smoke and haze, and Ventanus has something of an answer when he sees the cracked structure at the very heart of the fortress. Like the hardened structure of an aircraft hangar, it has withstood the barrage enough to remain standing. Sections of its roof have caved in where the supporting walls have collapsed. Ventanus can see no defensive works in its construction. It is a giant dome, embellished with elaborate carvings, a pair of decorative towers and a wide entrance without gates. Its construction is grandiose, and Ventanus realizes he has seen its like before.
"What do you think that is?" asks Sidance. "A keep? Somewhere to make a last stand?"
"No," says Ventanus, "it's not a keep. But I know what it is now. I've seen buildings like this before."
"Where?"
"On Monarchia," says Ventanus. "It's a temple."
Chapter 26. Ingenium Subiaco does not remember falling asleep, but that is surely what has happened. It is understandable. Toiling in perpetual twilight with no rest in the darkness and no respite from the task in hand, no one could remain awake for as long as he has. He is dreaming. Of that he's sure, for he travels the same silvered caves of his nightmares. He has come here night after night, dragged down into horrors that play out in an endless loop. That the experience never changes, offers no respite, only dark foreknowledge of the nightmarish flight from the multi-jointed creatures with the polished steel claws that tap, tap, tap upon the rock. The cave is the same strange silver, glistening with moisture, and with the now omnipresent threat lurking just out of sight. He knows the apparently solid walls of the cave are nothing of the sort. He knows what lurks behind the fragile skin of reality, and as much as he wishes to, he cannot unknow it. Half-glimpsed forms flit around him like darting smoke. He moves through the caves hurriedly, expecting that at any moment the walls will start peeling back to reveal the corruption beneath. He hears voices, but they're meaningless to him, and he cannot answer them. At every step, he feels as though he's being guided. But by who or what? He cannot say. The sense of expectation is almost unendurable, like a guillotine blade suspended a hair's breadth over the back of his neck. Subiaco wills himself to wake, but he has long since learned that he is powerless to control the inevitable progression of this terror. Sure enough, he hears the faint sound of tapping, like rats in the walls. Tap, tap, tap. Subiaco breaks into a run as he hears the clack of claws again and again. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, 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 tap. Louder now, coming from all around him. This is new. This is his nightmare moving to a higher level of terror. Then, as though a flame has been taken to the papier-mâché backing of the walls, they begin to disintegrate, blackening and spiralling away like dying embers. The walls slough from the familiar rusted lattice supporting them, and the terrible void behind is revealed once again. It churns like the depths of a hideously polluted ocean, saturated with the filth and mire of an entire species. What is in there is not alien. It is not the horrific byproduct of some race inimical to mankind. With unasked-for clarity, he understands that this ocean of madness belongs to his people. Humanity creates this realm of insanity, and Subiaco runs as he hears the claws of his demonic pursuers tearing their way through once more. This time, they're not just behind him. They are all around him. The wall ahead of him bulges as something presses its unnatural bulk against the lath, and Subiaco sees gleaming fangs and amber eyes, each slitted with a dagger slash of onyx. The tear splits wider, and a brood of beasts with claws of polished steel spill into the hollow cavern. Their blades gleam with murder, and their flesh is fashioned from the skinless bodies of everyone he knows and loves. Screaming faces howl in torment from heaving animal flanks, and their limbs are the beast's limbs, fused together in some awful biological abortion. The skulls of the beasts are metallic, gleaming wetly through pasted-on skin. Even stretched out, he recognizes the faces there, and his scream is one of abject loss. Subiaco runs, and the beasts are hard on his heels, stalking him, toying with him. They could catch and kill him any time they want, but there is too much pleasure to be taken in the hunt. He feels their hot breath upon him, rancid and empty. Subiaco knows there is only one way out, and he races onwards, hoping with every breathless stride that he will reach the great Cyclopean gateway with its golden seal. Only the gateway offers sanctuary. Subiaco wakes, the cries of the demons ringing in his ears. And nothing has changed. Chapter 27. The interior of the temple is a slaughterhouse, and Ventanus can make no sense of it. It is cold inside, freezing even. The heat from the dying star and the bombardment does not penetrate here, and steam rises from every legionary's backpack. Columns of light stab down from the cracked roof, and the poisonous fumes of burning war materiel linger at the openings in the wall, as though unwilling to enter. Ventanus smelled the blood before he took one step within, and now he has an answer as to what has become of the word-bearers. They are in the temple, and they are all dead. Their bodies are arranged in what is clearly a pattern, each one apparently still standing. This is an illusion created by the fact that each enemy legionary is held upright by a sharpened spar of blackened iron. Several thousand word-bearers have been impaled here, their bodies arranged in a form that clearly has some significance. What that might be is a mystery to Ventanus. Icos Lamiad and Caius Celaton lead their warriors through the columns of dead word-bearers. Celaton carries the fourth company standard, that glorious dented reminder of all they have lost and all they fight to keep. The contemptor, Telemachus, keeps pace with Lamiad, as though he is the Tetrarch's personal bodyguard. The spinning barrels of his assault cannon whine as the weapon sweeps left and right in search of a living target. Sidance stays at Ventanus' side. His expression is unreadable behind his helm's visor, but his body language is unambiguous. "Who did this?" he asks. He doesn't understand yet, but Ventanus does. "They did it to themselves." Sidance's head snaps around. Ventanus doesn't know whether the other captain is more horrified at the idea of warriors doing this to themselves, or that Ventanus has understanding enough to know it. He shakes his head and moves on. Nearly 1,000 ultramarines stand within the temple, shocked beyond words at this latest atrocity. None of them can make sense of what they're seeing. It is too alien to their understanding and fits no model of war they have been taught. Ventanus approaches the nearest word-bearer and lifts his head. The dead man wears no helmet, and his face has been cut open with hard slashes from a sharp blade. His features are contorted with a mixture of horror and devotion. The symbols are oddly geometric and unpleasant to look at in ways beyond the obvious. The pattern of impaled bodies becomes clearer the closer Ventanus gets to the centre of the temple. The groups of ultramarines are naturally funneled together as they approach the middle of the vaulted chamber. Ventanus feels the temperature drop still further.
"They are arranged in equidistant columns," says Lamiad, his half-flesh, half-cracked ceramic face managing to convey the disgust they all feel. "They radiate outwards, from a central point."
"Suggesting that what's at the centre is important," says Ventanus.
"A fane's nave is designed to lead to a central altar," agrees Lamiad. "The place of worship."
"Worship?"
Sidon spits the word. "I thought we'd cure them of that half a century ago."
"Clearly the lesson did not take," says Lamiad, gesturing with his one good arm to the sacrificial massacre around them.
The limb he lost early in the conflict could be restored, his face repaired. The technology and the craftsmen required are available, but Lamiad has chosen to remain as he is. His mythology has become important to Kalth, and it is a sacrifice he bears willingly.
Ventanus has the utmost admiration for Icos Lamiad, and hopes he will be as strong as the Tetrarch when the time comes for him to make such a sacrifice.
"So what's at the centre?" asks Celaton, holding the standard at his side. "I don't see an altar."
Celaton is right, there is no altar, merely a sunken pit from which issue tendrils of drifting mist. Ventanus leads the way, his fingers closing over the hilt of his sword.
Everyone here is already dead, but the reassurance of a weapon in his hand is always welcome.
As Ventanus approaches the pit, he sees that it goes down for 3 meters, and at its centre is another impaled body. A word-bearer, one clad in crimson armour bedecked with fluttering oath paper and stamped with golden scriptwork. This is no line warrior. Every plate and edge has been crafted by hand, shaped by a master artificer, and polished with a devotion that only a high-ranking war leader could earn. The parchment-white face is that of a cannibal ghoul, a lipless horror of gaunt cheekbones, sunken eyes and a hairless scalp. More of the geometric symbols have been cut into the bone of his exposed skull, where the skin has been peeled away. A ragged hole has been smashed through into the empty void of his brain pan.
"Fodral fell, I presume," says Ventanus.
Bodies are heaped around Fell's corpse. Cultist warriors, their bodies cut open and emptied. They are staged in poses of devotion, arms chained to the spike-topped staff upon which Fell is impaled, mouths slack with praise, eyes stitched open in adoration.
"What's that he's stuck with?" asks Eleton. "It's different from the others. That symbol."
"I saw the same thing over and over again," says Sidance. "I'd always thought it was some kind of unit marking. A load of the rabble we broke through to get to you at Numinous carried staves just like it."
"No," says Icos Lamiad. "It is not a unit marking, not as we understand it. It is a totem, an icon of their new masters. As we still carry the Aquila, our enemies now carry this. They call it the Octed."
Ventanus feels a spasm of revulsion at the word. He looks at the staff, its thick inscribed haft and eight radiating spoke blades mirroring the arrangement of the dead word-bearers. He has seen enemy champions carrying this symbol before them, brandishing it like a holy relic.
"We should get out of here," says Ventanus. "Let Torin's guns level this place."
Fodral Fell's head snaps up, and his lipless sneer pulls tight over his skull.
"Guns won't save you now,"
says a bleak voice that tears from the corpse before a froth of tar-black fluid vomits from its mouth onto the corpses at its feet.
"The Neverborn are coming for you all."
The ultramarines step back from the pit, revolted and shocked. Fodral Fell's body spasms, a series of bone-snapping convulsions that would surely have killed him had any life remained in him. The word-bearer dances in his impalement as a tidal wave of black, bilious fluid, noxious and viscous, continues to pour from his mouth. It is an impossible amount, more than a body could possibly contain. It squirts from his eyes and ears, it flows from his nose and jets from his mouth like a pressurized hose. The pit fills with piscous fluid, a seething cesspool of the darkest corruption. Fodral Fell's skull is now fully submerged, but Ventanus can still hear his gleeful mantra.
"The Neverborn are coming. The Neverborn are coming."
Only the bladed finial of the Octed staff remains above the oily liquid. Inky smoke coils from its spiked tips. Ropes of it writhe like mating serpents, spreading overhead like a veil of shadows, reaching out to the impaled corpses spread throughout the fane.
"Back!"
cries Ventanus, now understanding that they've been lured into a trap, the very doctrines that saved them from destruction now turned against them.
"Get to your vehicles and withdraw! Go! Now!"
The pit bubbles over, the protoplasmic black ooze spreading over the bloody ground like an unstopped oil well. Bubbles of unnatural matter form and burst, carrying the stink of the charnel house and the buzz of a million corpse-eating flies.
"The Neverborn are coming."
The ultramarines retreat in good order from the growing pool of darkness at the heart of the chamber. A miasma of black smoke fills the temple, the vile breath of corrupt and demonic gods.
"The Neverborn are coming for you all."
And the dead warriors of Fodral Fell open eyes of blackest night. Chapter 28. Holbeloth steps away from the Dark Apostle as he sees the curling horn was not some ornamentation wrought upon his helm, but a part of Malloc Carthos' skull. The ridged appendage of bone extrudes from a swollen mass of necrotized tissue, veined with blood and coated with sticky, foul-smelling liquid. Nor is that the only change in Malloc Carthos' appearance. His skin has taken on a rugose quality, and his eyes are now opaque orbs of sickly orange.
"Do you know Sorat Chure?"
asks Cartho, his mouth a rip across a yellow skull. His lips are bloody, where serrated triangular teeth have torn them.
He understands many of the hidden truths of the universe, not least of which is the power of betrayal. He knows something of the potency of its impact in the immaterial realm. To betray a friend is one thing, a trusted friend even more so. He took that lesson to heart when he began this.
Hal Belloth had heard the name, a whisper of one destined for great things.
But Lord Aurelian taught me that to betray a brother... Ah, now that holds the greatest power of all,
continues Carthow.
Their screams were like the Phoenicians' sweetest wine, their blood a baptism richer than any rain down by Angron himself. Fel was the greatest prize, a warrior whose dreams were on the very cusp of being realized when they were snatched away. Such towering desire unmade and dashed before his very eyes.
Carthow gurgles with laughter at the memory. Hal Belloth's hand slides around the grip of his sword.
Fel is gone, says Carthow, but you can still claim what he desired.
Why should I trust you?
Because you have no choice,
says Carthow, pointing towards the horizon with a hand that looks a lot less like a hand with every passing moment.
Watch the melodrama of the universe at play,
says Carthow, as a darkly radiant light erupts on the horizon. Hal Belloth lifts a gauntlet to shield himself from the new sun that boils up in a mushrooming cloud of atomic fire. He knows where that sun has touched down and scorched the world to glass.
What have you done?
He gasps. The Dark Apostle does not answer, dropping to one knee and gasping in dark rapture.
What have you done?
Demands Hal Belloth again.
The old beliefs pass away, and a great light shows us the way,
says Carthow, looking up at him with a predatory grin, as he quotes from the Book of Lorgar.
Now, brace yourself.
Horrified, Hal Belloth can only shake his head.
For what?
He asks.
A fall.
Chapter 29. The conference chamber of the Ultimus is a hair's breadth from panic. There was no warning, no hint of yet another disaster, but when it came, it was as sudden and shocking as the moment the word-bearers first opened fire. Another underground shelter is gone, transformed into a seething atomic cauldron of death. Even without the geosats, Arcology X's surface augurs are more than able to read the unimaginable spike of radioactive energy from the west. Pictors and rad counters combine their data on the plotting table, and Torren watches as the towering pyrocumulus of firelit smoke takes shape on the western horizon.
The Emperor protects,
weeps Captain Ulliot, clutching at something hung around his neck.
He is the light and the way.
We just lost another one, didn't we?
Says Hamadri, gripping the edge of the plotter tightly as the first shockwaves transmitted through the lithosphere shake the walls of the Ultimus. Torren nods, too busy sifting the myriad inloads from her linked surveyors and augers. Orbital scans combine with surface readings to build a more complete picture of what they've just lost. A bone-deep rumble fills the room as the surface of Kalth is wrenched and torn by the force of what Torren now understands is a subterranean detonation powerful enough to have ripped its way to the surface. These are just the first shockwaves racing from the blast. There will be worse to come.
Which one?
Asks Ulliot, the steel in his voice unwavering as dust and shards of ceiling tiles fall to the floor in a clatter of stone fragments.
Magnesi, Caprinius, which one, damn it?
His lapse into catechism has passed, and he is barking orders like a soldier again.
Triangulating now, says Torren.
The image of the atomic storm cloud fades from the plotter, and a base-level topographical map of Kalth's surface takes its place. Data coheres, readings correlate. An icon to the west begins to blink furiously. Hamadri and Ulliet look up in puzzlement, but Torren is just as surprised.
Uranic radial,
she says, as though not yet ready to believe her own incontrovertible data conclusion.
It's gone. Destroyed.
But, begins Uliot.
That's Hol Beloth,
finishes Hamadri, as the main blast wave hits Arcology X.